So let me clarify. I want to do three clarifications of disinterestedness. First, just picking up on what's driving everyone nuts. To say that the pleasure is disinterested is to say that the object's existence is not the cause of our pleasure, nor does our faculty of desire strive to cause the existence of the object. Instead, the object's existence is only the occasion for the pleasure which is elicited by the free play of the imagination and the understanding in apprehending the object. Now, to say that the pleasure is disinterested does not entail what everyone is worried about, indifference to the existence of the object. Because while pleasure and beauty is inherently disinterested, as Allison rightly points out, that in itself can give rise to interests, namely that there be museums, that we have a healthy art, that we have aesthetic education. Okay? So disinterest is not indifference. It only says that in a certain way, the pleasure is, shall we say, desire-free. We have the pleasure in the mere contemplation of the object, is what Kant says over and over again. Now, two further clarifications. One is, what exactly is disinterested? And secondly, how does the aesthetic pleasure relate to the stuff about life? So, first, the question of what is disinterested. And I'm here following an essay by Nick Zangwill in the Guire Anthology, Zangwill, an essay called Unkantian Notions of Disinterest. And Zangwill rightly comments that disinterest, despite the way it sounds, directly refers neither to attitudes nor attention, but solely to the pleasure itself. So what is disinterested is the pleasure we take. So, at 205, paragraph 2, he says, all he wants to know is whether my mere presentation of the object is accompanied by a liking, no matter how indifferent I may be about the existence of the object of this presentation. So it's the pleasure that's disinterested. Now, the idea that it's the pleasure that is disinterested, which is to say when it is in no way bound up directly with a desire, is what, again, entails that we are not concerned fundamentally for its real existence as our primary motive. Disinterested pleasure, Zangwill states, has a desire-free causal functional role. Pleasure is disinterested when the route from the representation of the object to the response of pleasure entirely bypasses desire. That's what makes it disinterested. I merely contemplate it. I don't contemplate it because I desire something from it. I merely contemplate it. But in that contemplation, I feel a pleasure. Hence, it bypasses the structures of both empirical and moral desire. Said differently, pleasure in the beautiful is a response to the representation of the object and to it alone. Now, that said, it follows that Kant is not making the argument, although it can sound like he is, that, and this is an argument that people developed after Kant, that there's such a thing as an aesthetic attitude or an aesthetic form of attention. And the claim here is that if we regard any object in a disinterested manner, that is, there's a way of attending to objects, which we call a disinterested attention, and that through disinterested attention, we can come to experience an object as beautiful. Okay, that's the theory of the aesthetic attitude. And that we can take this attitude toward any possible object. Now, the point here is that attending is something we do. Feeling pleasure is something that happens to us. Whether or not there are desires operative in my perceptual attention, that is, what are the motives? I mean, why have I gone to the museum to look at the object? Well, maybe because I have to do it for an aesthetics class. So I attended very carefully, and I'm highly motivated to attend very carefully. All of this is irrelevant to the question of whether the pleasure derived from such attention or contemplation is or is not disinterested. That will only occur, Kant will say, right, if I'm attending to the form, etc., etc. Since the desires motivating attention need not intervene in the root from representation to pleasure, pleasure in the beautiful can still be a direct response to the object. So whatever my motivation, right? And I probably don't know what my motivations are for going to the museum. Whatever my motivations are, the question is, does my pleasure arise from the mere contemplation? Now, that said, I think that Zengwill pushes the difference between disinterested pleasure and disinterested attitudes too far. And I think he pushes them too far because he presupposes that there is simply no connection between a disinterested pleasure and the attitudes or modes of attention by which we judge an object to be beautiful. But that cannot be quite right. Because after all, one of the questions I might reasonably ask myself in finding myself in a heightened state of pleasure when regarding an object is the pleasure I'm finding something that connects this object to me and my personal history? Or is it something that is occurring from the mere contemplation of it? Which is to say, I can ask myself, right, if I want to know whether my pleasure is disinterested, I might well want to check the attitude or motivations at work in my attention. For example, let me take an easy example. I know that everyone who's cool thinks this is a beautiful painting. So I get in front of it and I look really hard at it. Yeah, it's beautiful, right? But now I'm really worried, right? I want to know, am I finding it pleasurable because of the mere effect of attending to it, or am I motivated to call it beautiful by this knowledge that everyone else already thinks it's beautiful? So I want to know whether my attitude is motivation. So although, properly speaking, what's disinterested is the pleasure, the notion of attitude is not irrelevant. Second problem. Problem of pleasure in life. We've already seen that pleasure as a feeling for life involves the representation of the agreement of an object or action with the subjective conditions of life. That is, the conditions under which the faculty of desire becomes active in striving to generate objects. So that's our interested notion. So the feeling of life, right, and this is why there's a puzzle here, seems to intrinsically connect the pleasure with the interests of desire. And that means we haven't yet been able to make sense of how the feeling of life business connects with the pleasure business, right? Because in feeling alive, I'm interested. Well, we also found last week in the first introduction, page 231, if you remember, I underlined the fact that Kant there gives two accounts of pleasure. One, the one we've already just seen, and he says, remember I said this is the transcendental definition of pleasure. And it's a mental state in which a presentation is in harmony with itself and which is the basis either for merely preserving this state itself, for the state in which the mental powers further one another in a presentation preserves itself, or for producing the object of this presentation. Now, this idea of maintaining ourselves in a state is equally the notion of pleasure that we noticed in paragraph 10, page 220. I guess we didn't notice that. So he says there, consciousness of a presentation's causality directed at the subject's state so as to keep him in that state may here designate generally what we call pleasure. So there's two notions of pleasure now. The kind of pleasure derived from the satisfaction of desire, right? And the pleasure involved in being in a state in which we wish to keep ourselves in that state. So the obvious question that arises at this juncture is, how does the pleasure of mere consciousness of the effort of mind to conserve its present state connect to the feeling of life? Can you say what the question is again?
It's exhausting, isn't it?
We discovered that there are now broadly two different kinds of pleasures, transcendentally speaking. one source of pleasure that comes from desire and fulfillment. The second kind of pleasure now in preserving oneself in a particular state, to be a self-maintaining system. That is a state that is both cause and effect of itself. And it's that second pleasure that is clearly the kind of pleasure that we take in the aesthetic. Okay, we want to preserve the state we're in. But the problem with that is we don't know how to connect it to the feeling of life. Of course, the feeling of life is ordinarily connected to the desire pleasure structure. So, put the question another way, is aesthetic pleasure, as Kant said, really connected to the feeling of life, which after all must be biological life, and is the same life that we share with non-rational animals. There is a patent disconnect here. Well, the only person I know who has, that's not quite true. McCreel, in his book on hermeneutics and in the third critique, has a go at this problem. Longuenesse has a very, very surprising solution to this issue. She says that the life whose consciousness is aesthetic pleasure might be the life of what Hegel will later call spirit. That is, the life of the universal community of human minds. So Longuenesse's hypothesis is that the feeling of life is the feeling of what Hegel calls spiritual life, by which he means the life of the universal community of human minds. Now, saying this is obviously a stretch. And it's a stretch for two clear reasons. The first is the following. Why think that there is a connection between biological life and spiritual life? Is the notion of life as used in biological life really the same as the notion of life in spiritual life? Isn't that just a mere metaphor? And our worry here, and I just want to get the depth of the worry right, is equally the problem as it arises in Aristotle. Right? Because we know that Aristotle has two words for life. Zoe, which is biological life, the mere being alive, and bios, or bios, which for Aristotle is a way of life. Right? Say we are political animals. It's our way of life. And the question here is the same as the question as it might be put in Aristotle, namely, what is the connection between a feeling of life in the biological sense and a feeling of life as the life of a people? Are we just using metaphors here? So this is the first problem, is it merely metaphorical? And the second problem is the obvious one, Kant ain't Hegel. Well, Longuenesse knows that. So the first thing she wants to say is, of course, there can be no pleasure outside the feelings of a living entity in the biological sense. That being conscious is always the consciousness of a corporeal being. So what is at stake is the way in which the consciousness of ourselves as corporeal beings is connected to the feeling of the life of the mind. Well, the crux for Longuenesse is in that second definition of pleasure, that is, being in a state that seeks to maintain itself. And to say we are in a state that wishes to maintain itself is to say we are in a state in that is both cause and effect of itself. But to say that something is both cause and effect of itself is exactly how Kant defines life as a capacity of corporeal beings. That is, the idea of a self-maintaining state to be both cause and effect of itself is Kant's definition of life as a capacity of corporeal beings. So, at the very least, in defining the second notion of pleasure in the way he does, he is pointing to the fact that this is one that occurs as a function of the mind of a corporeal being. So the thought now is going to be, Longuenesse argues, that it becomes apt to say that in aesthetic pleasure, the mind is cause and effect of nothing but itself. And to say in aesthetic pleasure that the mind is cause and effect of nothing but itself, being in this self-maintaining state, then it seems right to say that aesthetic pleasure is a feeling of life, in this case, the restricted sense of the life of the mind, that is, of the life of our representational capacities. So at least there is Kant is drawing on the fact, let's put it this way, of what it is to be a corporeal being in his second definition of pleasure. Nevertheless, Longuenesse says, I'll come back to the other side in a moment. The term life has at the same time its most usual sense, the capacity of a corporeal being to be cause and effect of its own activity, since there would be no feeling of pleasure unless the representational capacities were those of a living thing in the ordinary sense of the term. Well, why is she then tempted by the notion of life of the spirit? Well, she's tempted by the notion of life of spirit because what it is about the state of mind that elicits this peculiar kind of pleasure that is aesthetic pleasure is the very fact that it is universally communicable. That is what makes the pleasure aesthetic pleasure. And this is just going to be the second moment now. She's just pointing to the second moment. The peculiar kind of pleasure proper to aesthetic pleasure is that it is universally communicable or makes a claim to the possibility of being shared by all human beings. So she wants to say that in a second sentence, then, aesthetic pleasure is a feeling for life, or a feeling of the life of an a priori grounded community of judging subjects. A community grounded in the a priori representational capacities shared by all judging subjects.
Yeah. One wonders whether, and this may be what Mackerel is referring to, wouldn't be better to refer to Diltai's notion of life, which is related to Hegel's, but different insofar as it straddles the line between the biological and the cultural in a different way than Hegel's notion of spirit does, or it seems closer to the biological.
Say more.
Well, right, because he wants this notion below the concept of universal communicability, of a community of, and so my understanding is actually he gets this from different techniques, so using his concept of life would, I don't know, it's just a supposition.
I mean, the problem with the Diltaian view is that it doesn't quite connect to the actual theses of the third critique.
Right.
Right? So what's very clever about Longuenesse here is she is asking about the status of the pleasure. And what we're going to find, one of the things that we're about to discover in the second moment, is that the pleasure we experience in finding an object beautiful is that our state of mind is universally communicable. That is, that the universal communicability of our state of mind is itself an ingredient in the pleasure that we call aesthetic pleasure. So that the pleasure is both, in one way, related to the object, I find, and in another way, it's related to the fact that my being in this state, right, is a state that in its self-maintaining character, I judge to be one that is capable of being shared by everyone. And that's not an extraneous fact about the state. That's a ingredient in the state. Right? So this is we're now moving into the second moment. This is actually the very question of the status of universality. So the thought here that I'm struggling with to communicate is that part of the pleasure we take in the beautiful, and I'll hammer this down shortly, but beauty talk is inherently normative. To say that an object is beautiful is inherently a normative claim. But because, which is to say, it is not a claim about what I like, and I don't care what anyone else thinks, to judge an object beautiful is the claim that my judgment is a pleasure that belongs intrinsically to the judgment of that object. And the question, of course, for Kant is, well, what is objectivity here? And objectivity is not now grounded in the concept of the object, but in my subjective state. So the only meaning for objectivity in aesthetics is what makes something objective is that it's universally shareable. Because it's about my state of pleasure, and I'm claiming that my pleasure is objective. That's why I call it, it is beautiful. Not, it tastes good to me, or I like it. So something about the affirmative nature depends upon the judgment having an inherently normative character. And the inherently normative character turns out to be one of universal shareability. And then the issue is going to arise, which I'll come back to, but what I'm now claiming is the pleasure we take is bound up with that universal shareability. So it's not just that we find looking at the object okay, but in being in that state, I feel I am in what Kant will call an exemplary state of regard. That is one which anyone, if they had their wits about them, would respond to likewise. Which is why we can hardly bear contradiction in aesthetic matters. Right? That we find it difficult is because of the inherent normative character of the claim. So that there's something about a judgment of taste that is necessarily about a community of sense. To make a judgment of state, a judgment of taste, is necessarily to claim that there ought to be a community of sense, that is, a community of responsiveness in light of this. Yeah. And I have to unpack all that, but that's the surface logic. And let me just say one more thing, and I'll get to your question. And it's that surface logic that Longuenesse is pointing to, why she wants to call it the life of spirit. Because she's saying that spirit, if spirit means nothing but, right, who we are as a ongoing community, then aesthetics is what calls into being the shareability of our sensory attunement to the world. That is, it's the normative structure, or potential normative structure, of our relatedness to everyone. Yeah. Right.
I made this judgment. I said to myself, it is painful. And I think when I said painful, what I meant was anyone hitting themselves with a hammer in this situation would feel pain. That the word painful sort of entails a kind of universal paradigm. I wonder if
But it's just false.
That's false.
Yeah, I mean, it's just notorious that what some people find painful or cold or hot or heavy, other people don't. Right? It's a feeling, and of course, it's a feeling that I'm not claiming that you're feeling. I'm not claiming that it's merely subjective, but I am claiming that it's not normative. No one has a stake in claiming that everyone, when they feel a pain, that everyone ought to feel likewise. You may worry that other people feel likewise, or be interested in the fact that it's a good guess that other people will feel likewise and want to avoid that. But it's not normative. There's nothing oughtish about it. So don't. So the normativity here is an oughtish character, right? The way morality does. While saying I feel pain, at best is objective in the way that it is read. Is objective. But pain is a tougher one because it is relative. Not normative. Yeah.
I don't want to harp on the disinterested problem, but I just have a hard time trying to figure out if our experience of pleasure is necessarily bound up with universality, and universality is not incidental to our feelings of pleasure, then how are we not invested in the universal as soon as we have a feeling of pleasure? And how can we be disinterestedly?
No, it's because it's disinterested. That is universal.
But you said that we have like a real investment in making sure that you and I have the same.
Once I make the judgment that it's universal, right? Then, of course, because I think it's my state is normative, if you disagree, I will be pained. So it's not as if I'm indifferent to my judgment. To say that the pleasure is disinterested is not to say that I don't care about it. It's the disinterestedness that makes me care. It's the source of my care that because I have no personal investment, I just find this beautiful. Then if someone disagrees with me, that's what makes me angry. How can you disagree? I'm a perfectly objective judge. I stood there. I'm a good aesthete. I know my place, you know. And now you disagree? How do I know what you're feeling? What you're feeling as a human being if we disagree? Right? Because what's at stake, just to make it obvious, is that if we can share in that sensory response, then how do you and I share a world at all? Except instrumentally. I mean, I know you and I can negotiate, you know, but somehow, what is at stake is the shareability of our subjective life. That's why it matters. It's because exactly it's my feeling. And my feeling I now want to claim is one that is intrinsically shareable. And that's part of the energy of aesthetic discourse, its normativity. If it didn't have that normativity, then the discussion would be like the New York Times restaurant pages, right? You know, you like this, I like that, you know, too dark, too rich, too this, you know. It's a matter of taste. That's the
criteria
phrase.
Criteria gets a grip there, too.
What?
I mean, criteria and being able to carry out a conversation, and as Cavell would say, it does get a grip. In other
sure.
Words, it's not merely.
It's not merely.
This.
Otherwise, the critics would be out of the job,
yeah.
Right? But the point is that they are cultivating various communities,
yeah.
Not with absolute normativity. If you are the kind of person who likes good French cooking, then. But what do you say? I don't like good. I spent 6 months, six weeks in Paris, and I'm a star to death. I couldn't get a good meal. I don't like French cooking. It's too rich, too heavy. I can see you all going crazy. He's nuts. I don't like French cookie. What happened to all those good Vietnamese restaurants? Okay. I thought that's why we went to Paris, for good Vietnamese food. Okay, let us begin section two and try to put this argument in some kind of order and see where it takes us. Paragraph six, as I've already mentioned, simply tries to make a direct inference from disinterestedness to universality. If I'm disinterested, then the object must be universal. And as now, there are two issues here. One, if this argument were sufficient, then there's absolutely no reason why Kant should have written anything more in this part. That should have been the end of it. Part two should have ended with paragraph six. We should have gone on to the rest. So Kant cannot intend that there be the inference from disinterest to universality be sufficient for understanding the universality of the judgment of taste. Right? It's not a logical inference. The second problem is, as everyone's pointed out, Kant is overly dependent on this two sources of motivation thesis. That is, he thinks if I can eliminate the fact that I have a private desire for the object, and I can eliminate the fact that it's bound up with a moral interest, if I can eliminate those two, then there could not be another interest at work. But he thinks that, and this is singular, this is me, this is everyone, he doesn't seem to think that there's a notion of some folk, right? That's the neglected alternative. So he misses out that there could be communal interests, that some of us find objects like this pleasurable. And he always thinks that some is reducible to one. But as Allison rightly points out anyway, this is not meant as a direct inference, but as a natural or reasonable conclusion that builds a bridge to the normative aspects of the judgment of taste. Further, because we can never know, and Kant knows that we can never know for certain whether a judgment of taste is fully disinterested, then disinterest, that is, I can't know for sure what my motivations are. Who knows what their motivations are in looking at an object? That there has to be more to the story about universality than the sense of disinterestedness. Indeed, we'll see in a moment that disinterestedness may actually be thought to be an inference from universality rather than the other way around. So the better way of looking at this section is he starts with a negative criterion of universality, disinterestedness, and the rest of the chapter attempts to provide a positive account of universality. Paragraph 7, I've already been talking about, because in paragraph 7, what's at stake is simply the attempt to demonstrate that beauty talk is inherently normative. And Kant wants to say that to say it's beautiful to me is a contradiction in terms, or it's not really an aesthetic judgment. To say, to your beloved, you are beautiful to me, is a way a kind of insult. You'll always be beautiful to me. Hedging one's bets. Which is to say that we, and to say this is when in an argument, if you, as it were, retreat to the point of saying, but I find it beautiful, that retreat is a retreat away from aesthetic discourse altogether. So that it is part of the logic of criticism in the arts that one is not attempting to say that you or you alone find something beautiful, but to express or give an account of your response to an object that gives anyone listening to your account reasons to share it, that is, reasons to begin to appreciate the object in the way you do. Yeah.
But how can there be reason giving?
The reason giving is the way aesthetic criticism works is I am not giving you, let me give a concrete example. If I say to you, yeah, but you haven't noticed the sweep of the line, right? And then you say, oh yeah, there is a sweep of the line. The fact that you agree there is a sweep of the line is not a reason for you to find it beautiful. Because that's simply a bringing of that line under a conceptual description. You actually have to, again, engage the object and find that in noticing that feature of it, you are put into the relevant state. So the work of criticism is to try to articulate the relationship between one's response to an object. The easiest examples here is just pick up any piece of Pauline Kael's movie criticism. Because she always starts with these strong feelings about the object and then begins talking about the object so that you realize that these are not private feelings at all, but ways of beginning to think about what noticing how the film works involves and makes you want to then look for yourself. So criticism is an objectification of one's feeling response in relationship to structures of the object for the sake of drawing someone's attention to the object. But nothing about the criticism is on its own. There's no criticism that is QED. A piece of art criticism doesn't say it has this, that, and the other property, QED, it's beautiful. It's rather, if you think about it in these terms, you will find it beautiful.
Not something subject to reason giving, right? And I'm saying reason giving in the QED sense, right? But I don't see how there can be any reason giving. Since the point of criticism is just to draw repeatedly or more thoroughly draw attention to the object, I mean, why not just say look again, look again, look again?
Because the aesthetic objects we're most interested in, namely artworks, are amazingly complex. And it's really unclear what it is to listen to, you know, a Bach fugue. To get what it is to hear that, or to get what it is to, you know. As I was saying, I kind of schlepped around the country with this long piece on Matisse. And it was great because I walked into every audience for whom Matisse was dead as a doornail, an example of everything that was wrong with modernism, and I tried to bring Matisse back to life, right? To make it riveting again for them. But that takes you know, complicated ways of articulating what's there. So it's not in the case of natural objects, you know, our capacity for criticism is pretty limited. In the case of art objects, because they are intrinsically complex, caught up in complex histories, and that you cannot see them without a bit of culture behind you and fully appreciate them, then there's a lot to see. But yeah, eventually you're going to see, as Cavell says, you have to end up with, don't you get it? Yeah. So there's a don't you get it moment essential to art criticism. Right? But criticism works precisely because it makes, it does the things, I mean, the great critics are exactly the ones who, not just one time, but time after time after time, know how to lead us into the right kind of engagement with the work. That's the fault. And that builds up a culture of shareability. So criticism is the medium by which we acculturate ourselves into a community of feeling. That's the thesis. So you're right, it's not QED stuff, but then what makes us think that QED stuff is the most important type of criticism, right? So the question of art opens up a different relationship of discursive writing to objects than deductive writing.
Well, I actually already agree with every point that you make about criticism. That seems completely exogenous to what Kant is doing, we're talking about.
Because?
Well, where does he talk about it?
Oh, in the discussion of art and genius. Right. So again, remember, we're starting with the pure judgment of taste, the simplest, what we're trying to do is, let's see if we can get what it is, you know, somewhere, Schiller, you know, just gives these, you know, two kinds of lines, this one and this one, you know. Oh yeah, this is a beautiful line, this is it. And he wants a simple case because he wants to see what is at stake in the pure judgment of taste so that in complicated cases that are not pure, we know how to think about them. Right? So there may be a lot going on in art that is not merely about beauty. But in the first instance, what we want is, as it were, to use a minimalist account to get clear about beauty itself and then build to all the complexities. That's exactly how the book works. It starts with pure judgments, moves to sublime, then brings in artworks, and then all the morality, and then all of nature, right? I mean, it just gets more and more, you know. But it wants to start with, you know, just this. What's at stake when I say, whew, what a beautiful line. Hogarth has a lot to say, by the way. You read Hogarth on beautiful lines. It's stunning. So it's beginning with that, and it's because, let me just, and I can see where your worry is coming from, it's because he thinks that if we begin too far away with the arts, we're going to miss the motion of pleasure, and we're going to miss the role of pleasure in our judgments. So he wants to isolate that notion of the aesthetic bit, the pleasurable, sensuous, sensory bit, and then move to there, to the conceptual aspects. And he does think that it's important that it be, in his sense, you know, not cognitive, not conceptual. But that's the purity of it, not the whole story. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, if it's a, it's a non-concept, it's not conceptual. But this point about criticism is providing different conceptual perspectives or frameworks to look at
yep.
the artwork. And when you bring that to bear on the actual artwork, you're not necessarily determining it, but as something, but you nonetheless have this wealth of concepts that, in being brought to bear on the painting, provide you with the ability to fall or bring about this harmony of effect. So I'm just wondering, how do we?
Form is the word you're missing, right? Okay. What I'm going to do in my art criticism.
But is, some of it can be contentful, though. Not, I mean, histories, right? That might, a story that you might come up with that might add an element to the what's already there, but isn't necessarily a form of the painting. Could
ah, great. No, no, no. I mean, and Kant's answer is going to be, it's, he's going to distinguish between free beauties and dependent beauties, right? And he's going to try to explain how it is that when we look at especially narrative art, right, that is paintings that are about events, what's going on? How do we judge the relationship between the narrative and the experience of the beauty or sublimity in it? And he's going to insist that in a certain way, the aesthetic moment is still going to be connected to the appreciation of the form, even if that form is going to be the conveyor of something else. So he's going to have notions of aesthetic ideas, right? I mean, there's all sorts of stuff he's going to bring in later. But the notion of the pleasure is going to be the pleasure in the purposeful purposiveness without purpose of the form.
Yeah. Art, or is this only referring to painting? Is that what we mean by art here?
No. All the arts. Poetry, music.
But just because all sculpture. Of your examples have been painting, so
it's for this I use painting for the same reason I'm A, I write about painting, but B, I used to write about literature, but it's just too hard. I mean, well, you want me to tell you about Henry James? I mean, where do we get, you know? So, no, I use painting only because I just want you to think about simple cases to begin with. Right? I mean, and then ask about Kant's own hierarchy of the arts. He seems to actually think that poetry is the highest art. Because it's linguistic.
I'm asking because I thought that before you had, it almost seemed like you poo-pooed a Bach fugue before, so I was, unless I was...
Poo-pooed it? No, I was saying, on the contrary, I was just I was saying to understand fugal form from someone who can barely read Charles Rosen, you know, is immensely complicated, and therefore to appreciate a Bach fugue is immensely difficult. So I was trying to say difficulty and beauty can go together. And I was trying to explain how you can nonetheless think you have to hear it, and what else is there to do with a Bach fugue but hear it, but nonetheless to hear the richness and fullness of it is to understand the form. Which is hardly simple in the case of Bach. Yeah?
Can we go back to what you said, where Mel says that with the aesthetic judgment, the moment of don't you reach that moment, don't forget it. So
right.
Basically, that the moment of the set is always going to be non-conceptual.
Yeah.
But I don't see.
It's got to be either you feel the pleasure or you don't. And I can't, see, I can't, that's why there's no QED, right?
Right, but my problem is that I'm not sure how that's exemplary of aesthetic judgments. I feel like when you give reasons to prove something, why is this true? Why is this good? And you give many reasons and the chain of reasons, ultimately the moment of descent is still not conceptual.
Ah, well that's a Wittgensteinian thought. which I agree with, right? I mean, the point being that at least for Kant, and this is why the book is powerful, because we are inclined to say that there's a moment where here my spade is turned, I can do no more than say, you know, this is the way we do it around here, or that sort of thing. But for Kant's enough of a rationalist to think that certain concepts, so he still belongs to that idea that demonstrability for reason, just as the empiricist thought, right? Ideas are, the simplest thing directly apprehensible by the mind. So if you don't get it, then... that's point one. Point two, it's still a question of pleasure. So, of course, there's a moment of don't you get it when we disagree about, say, what plus two means, to use the Wittgensteinian example. But the don't you get it is not going to terminate in a subjective state, but of being able to go on. And that's a difference. But I am minded to say that it's closer to understand the aesthetic conditions of rational discourse is part of why I'm pushing the line I am with this. That is, let me put it another way. Just let me, and we'll end with this because it's already tomorrow. it looks as if sharing our sensible relationship to the world is a necessary condition for sharing the world rationally. That we begin by sensory attunements to the world and build up to rational structures, which then, of course, can take off in their own way. But when a mother is teaching a child, or when any teacher is engaging with children, what they are doing in the first instance is giving a sentimental education, giving them routes of pleasure, eat this, you'll enjoy it, trying to find how the world is sensory shared and building up to the conceptual. And I'm going to have a detailed argument of how that works next week, about how you build up from sensory and psychological structures to full conceptual structures. But yeah, so we might want to say that, but we also know that once we're conceptualized, then our concepts can push us apart. And aesthetics is a way of trying to reattune us to our sensory connectedness. Okay, last question.
Last question. Just to bring it back to the book view, it seems that instead of being thoroughly shareable, I just so love that it poo-pooed a Bach view.
Yeah, I know.
Back to Bach. I am an immature. but exactly, it seems that instead of being thoroughly shareable, it seems actually quite difficult to have pleasure in a Bach view without extremely complex conceptual acculturation.
Yeah.
And so there seems to be a sense of cultural mediation or some sort of mediation from that there is normativity in a universal or in pleasure as a universally normative claim to the possibility of universal normativity. And is this something that Kant will account for, or how does this factor into the idea of normativity as universality?
Well, he has to give an account of how art cultures develop and how they
all that.
Yeah, that kind of story. At the moment, and I just don't want to go any further, no matter where you are historically or culturally, if you claim that X is beautiful, then you are claiming that someone can, through a process perhaps of elaborate acculturation, come to a situation in which they are capable of feeling that claim. So to say that everyone ought to feel it as a normative claim is not the claim that everyone, if they came right here and now to this spot and looked or heard or read, would automatically feel it. Of course not. We're all at all sorts. But it is a claim about the status of your judgment, and it's no different. I mean, after all, when a Norwegian says, oh, the snow is, you know, and it gives some bit of snow that I know nothing about, of course they know, ah, you know, stupid New Yorkers, they don't know about the different snows. Miss Neela's Sense of Snow, whatever that book is called, you know, all the 17. But I can learn the different senses of snow. Right? Well, similarly, and that's an objective concept. Well, similarly for aesthetics. I mean, so objectivity is in principle shareability, not immediate shareability. It's not private, it's not from notion, you know. Okay, let us stop there before we get thrown out or walk out. And again, suffer with paragraph 9, and we'll pick up with paragraph 9 at the beginning of next time.